I think we're ready to kick off today's session. Today's speaker is Neil Weinstein, Executive Director of the Low Impact Development Center. Neil directs the Low Impact Development Center, a nonprofit water resource research organization based in Beltsville, Maryland. With over 20 years of experience in environmental planning, research, and design, much of his work has focused on how to effectively and efficiently use a landscape and built environment to create a sustainable infrastructure that protects natural resources and enhances the aesthetics, and quality of life in urban areas. Neil is one of the pioneers of LID and helped create the initial planning, design, and analysis tools that are the basis of LID strategies. He has worked to develop stormwater policies and strategies at the national and local levels through research, development, and policy analysis. Good afternoon, Neil.
Thank you, and welcome everyone. If you look at slide one, I'd just like to say that I think this is done by UNEP, United Nations organization, and it just shows all the complexity of an urban area that we have to deal with, the infrastructure, as well as the political and the social and economic issues. Next slide, slide two. Just a few, that's not advancing. Oh, there we go. Just a few seconds of shameless self-promotion here. We were started in 1998 as a nonprofit, and we actually got started. We got a small grant from EPA, Chesapeake Bay Program, Region 3, and Office of Water. And with that small grant, you can see throughout the country how much those initial efforts have really kind of blossomed and sprung LID into a national effort. Our group really looks on sustainable stormwater solutions. Our focus a lot on pilot projects, institutional development, manuals of practice. We're just a small group, but we partner a lot. When I put this presentation together, I was asked to put together about 100 and some slides and highlight some LID things, and I kind of contacted some people that I knew were doing some pretty innovative things out in the country, and I was just amazed at all the great projects that are out there. So my apologies if I didn't put your project in here, but we do have a time limitation. So with that, let's kind of get started. I just wanted to highlight a couple of things that we recently completed. One is LID for Phase 2 communities, and that's up on our website. Just type in Low Impact Development. We're getting a lot of feedback. There's a very good booklet on building the business case for LID prepared by LMI, Logistics Management Institute. I strongly suggest you download that. It's a great document. We're working with a team on WERF, Water Environment Research Foundation, on decentralized stormwater. And there's that webcast was last week, and I think there's a lot of good studies that WERF is doing on stormwater. NCHRP, which is the National Cooperative Highway Research Program, there'll be a report issued through the National Academy of Sciences on stormwater and LID coming up shortly. We've actually got an LID project here at headquarters, Navy EPA Region 3 partnership, and we're completing a grant on LID for big box retailers. So to them, because there's a couple efforts that are nationwide on LID. First is the ASC database, and I believe it's it's the BMP.org, and I think that's partially sponsored by EPA, but they're taking information on LID and other BMPs. ASCE, American Society of Civil Engineers, has an LID committee. Hopefully you can contribute to that. And also a really good website is the University, University of New Hampshire has a Stormwater Research Institute that has some really good studies. Oh, I'm sorry. We're on slide five. And so today's goals, introduction, I'd like to give an introduction and some background on LID. Put it in the context of watershed planning. Let you see some case studies from around the country and maybe some thoughts and ideas on where we're going. Slide six. What am I doing for time?
It's your
time. I have to warn you, I talk rather quickly. I usually get put at the end of any presentation because I can always catch up on time. But I think we'll have a little bit more time for questions. So what is LID? Let's start with a definition. really started about 10 or 11 years ago at Prince George's County, Maryland's DER, and coming up with the idea or the concept of using kind of uniformly distributed small-scale controls that were integrated into the site streets architecture. So the deal here was try to look at the hydrologic cycle or the water balance rather than centralized end-of-pipe controls. The first effort was put into a manual for Prince George's County in 97, which I worked on, and later became the abbreviated version and became the national LID manual done by Prince George's County in 99 and widely distributed on the net. I think that's easily available. So let's go to slide 7 and another definition. So what is LID? It's a stormwater management strategy concerned with maintaining or restoring natural hydrologic functions of a site, and that is each individual site. And the idea is to help meet stormwater management management goals, either new or retrofit construction. Looking at it as helping to meet regulatory requirements and natural resource objectives by primarily relying on the landscape and natural functions of evaporation, transpiration, filtering, groundwater recharge. And LID, for example, uses natural and built structural and non-structural features that reduce runoff volume and rate, filter pollutants, and facilitate water infiltration. And at the bottom there I have, thanks, Larry Kaufman. Larry is no longer with Prince George's County, but he's a consultant doing training on LID. And this is really his idea that a lot of us have really been working with for the last 10 years or so. Now, if we go to slide 8, the next couple of slides, I'd like to kind of clear up some things that we found going throughout the country talking about LID. I guess either some confusion or some misconceptions. It's interesting just to see by the time you get information third and fourth hand where things go. A lot of debate has been what's better, smart growth or LID. This always kind of confused me because what we're trying to get with LID is it's a site planning and design strategy. It's not land use approach to watershed management. We're looking at individual sites, maybe watershed level down to an individual site, and how we can best manage that runoff and rainfall. Moving to slide 9. Now, this slide is in the National LID Manual, and a lot of people have come up to me and say, LID is promoting sprawl because you're using 1-acre lots everywhere. Well, because people obviously sometimes don't read maybe as much as they should, we just use a slide to illustrate the effects of LID techniques. For example, it could have been a half acre or 10 acres. So we're not promoting that. We're just trying to show that we can take just about any site and alter that. Next on slide 10, conservation. A lot of people will say LID's conservation. And what we're really promoting is functional conservation. So, for example, that those kind of green blobs in the middle of the, which are woods, in the middle of the light green area, what we want to see is making those woodland areas functional. So just preserving woods is one thing, but how do you make it contiguous? How do you blend it into the entire wildlife corridor or stream protection strategy? And then finally, I don't have a slide illustrating that, but people will say, well, our soils are much different than they were in Prince George's County, and so we can't do LID here. The idea of low-impact development is that we're doing customized watershed design based on the existing conditions. So if you're in a clay soil, we want to do things that kind of replicate clay practices. Or, for example, if you're in an area of karst topography, maybe you're not as interested as infiltrating large amounts of water. So those are just a few things I'd like to kind of clear up. On slide 11, how this all started, this is a slide of Machu Picchu, and I like this slide because when you're up on a mountain and you can't run down to the 7-Eleven and get your bottled water all the time, you have to really use how look at how you can conserve and use water widely. It's not until really the last couple of years in mankind have we been doing things like this. I guess you could say this is a kind of a sidewalk shower or something. That's on slide 12. So as I think we've done some pretty interesting things with our stormwater. On slide 13, I think much of our early stormwater approach is really based on flood control technologies. You can just look at the, for example, Katrina, and it's come about the wetlands protection and using the water balance and natural cycles to help protect stormwater. But this is very easy to look at and figure, for example, that, don't worry about the equation on the bottom, it's just looking at peak rates and flows for stormwater management. This is the Los Angeles River, I believe, part of it. So we've really based much of our early stormwater on peak control rates. For example, this slide here, slide 14, illustrates Q, which is a peak discharge rate against time. This is a hydrograph. And the small green line would be existing conditions. So I know there's parts of the country, let's just talk about really kind of East Coast or Midwest, where we have kind of a gentle rise in the hydrograph and a small amount of volume. And then we look at in a developed condition of the orange, where we have much more volume and a very high peak occurs over a very short period of time, tremendous amount of energy and volume and work on our receiving waters. And in most conventional hydrology, you wouldn't really look at, if you look to the area on the bottom left corner where you don't see any of the green line, that would be represent where we have kind of infiltration or losses in the watershed. And we really kind of lose that. So when we look at peak flood control hydrology, controlling for like a 2-year, a 10, or 100 event, we really don't look at the whole water balance. Now, the reason for looking at the balance, if we go to slide 15, this is just showing in 1 year around Reagan Airport that almost 90% of the rainfall events are under a quarter of an inch. And in many existing control technologies, peak controls, we kind of ignore that volume. And so anything under maybe an inch is kind of let to run off. So with connectivity and impervious areas, what happens is that when it rains, essentially we have work on our receiving waters and pollutant runoff. Now, next slide, 16. This isn't snow. This is cuts from the roach coach that's in the industrial area upsize of this stormwater management pond. Now, this is a retrofit of a stormwater facility, and it was interesting to do this. They took down some trees, and we often, I think, in conventional approaches, especially end of pipe, are maybe trading one resource or another. And then when we get into areas, especially around Washington, we have very limited space, and land is an extremely high value. So we take something which really has no economic value. You can't build a building, you can't develop that, and that income is lost, especially in commercial spaces. And that's an important aspect thing I'm going to talk about a little bit later, is how we're going to really move more toward an asset management approach. Many of the impairments that we look at, we didn't really think of a few years ago. I just call this my Canadian TMDL goose. On slide 17. And, you know, for example, how do you manage or get rid of this, especially if it's a water shed impairment? And I tell some of my friends that we should just shoot these, but that would probably not be a political. There's actually better ways to get rid of them that are less invasive. But many of our issues are more complex in the urban environments, and I'm not sure how we can manage these. So here, this pond becomes more or less an attractive nuisance. On slide 18, I could say this is probably the state-of-the-art development in the United States. Here we have a shopping center with 5 or 10% green space in the parking lot, all totally developed and connected impervious area. Now, what we've done in many of our watershed protection schemes is to essentially segregate or isolate valuable resources. So if you look at that stream buffer to the north, yes, we have protected the stream with a buffer, but we're taking several acres of directly connected impervious area with all the volume, all the pollutants, and dumping it into this resource. So even though we've preserved a system, like when we go back to maybe the things we learned from the Macar back in the 70s, we still need to consider the energy inputs into that system. Right now, because of a lot of the traditional neighborhood developments, TNDs, or assemblies of land, we're even looking at large-scale big boxes and large-scale impervious areas. Now, this is up in Clarksburg, near me, in Maryland, and this is a planned community. Now, if you can just imagine on slide 19, what happens when you start to aggregate lots of these retailers, because the Target wants to be next to the Walmart, wants to be next to the Kohl's, and the large-scale impervious impacts, the large-scale water quality impacts that result from this. So what happens when we use these policies of just not keeping upland controls? And this is a study I worked on slide 20, and it's in Reston, Virginia. Now, if you've ever looked at land use, Reston is really the poster child for stream buffers. And we did this study. This is with a GKY group out of Reston. And you can see what happens to the stream. I mean, obviously, back when it was wooded many years ago, the stream wasn't as incised and maybe just had that little amount of water running through it. But it's enlarged itself to accommodate storm drainage. And most of this is because of very small drainage structures that have no controls. And you can see here, for example, on slide 21, the slide on the left shows the channel moving into next to a sewer line, and on the right-hand side, downcutting from the increased energy and discharge. There should be a study coming out shortly on slide 22. I'm not going to spend much time on this slide, by Watershed Management Institute, WMI, and they were looking at the biological indices in some streams in across the country in different sites. And one of the things they found is that on a large-scale basis, watershed, maybe some of the individual site BMPs that we populate our watersheds with aren't having a great effect. For example, the slide on the top compared to the slide on the bottom shows a controlled and an uncontrolled watershed. Now, WMI also did some really interesting things a few years back, where they talked about how many things were waived or not put in, not built correctly in urban watersheds. And I think a lot of that is because many of our regulatory schemes, our permit schemes, are not very flexible. They're very specific. And I think in urban areas you will find that we don't have, if we don't have flexibility because new two sites are alike, we can't always protect our watersheds, and we end up, local governments many times end up waiving things or modifying management practices in ways that they weren't meant to be done. Going to slide 22, this is a house in Bethesda, Maryland, near where I live, and you can see it's an old, probably 50s, 60s house, about on a little over a quarter of an acre. Now, this house is in the neighborhood. I think this house sells for about $500,000. Okay, so in many places in the country, people are going, whoa, or whoa. What happens is that people, builders, will tear these down block by block and build this. You can read about mansionization. This house is probably about $1.5 million, and they do get rid of the porta potty on the left in slide 24 when the person buys the house. But essentially, the local rules never really envisioned people tearing houses down and building them wholesale. So here we have just a tremendous increase in impervious area and coverage of the lot, and many of the local codes and ordinances don't address this, and people are struggling with how do you provide stormwater management to decrease the loads and impact, especially on many sensitive receiving waters. Another great slide I like is that it doesn't really exclude any class or type. There's many areas inside the Beltway here in Washington which are much less priced, and what's happening here, like if you look at this, this is a house built in the 40s on slide 25, and here, for example, it's nice and wooded, and trees and shrubs, and there's even this little driveway to the left that could be considered an NLID thing where we're not paving and it's just a little pathway. Well, what happens here on slide 26 is people will build up, pave up to the allowable percentage for driveways, and you may get two or three families living in a house, and the forest cover is gone with no compensation. So we say many areas with wholesale just cutting down of trees, and the codes essentially allow it without mitigation because, for example, I live in Maryland and we have a forest conservation, but once you get under an acre or 10,000 square feet or 5,000 square feet of clearance, it essentially gets waived. So this is one of the issues with smart growth, and I think we have to really start developing a strategy for this. And there's a book just came out by Richard McEwen and Alan Davis, slide 27, if you go to, on smart growth and stormwater management. I don't get a percentage of the book, but it's got a really lot of good stuff in it, and I'd recommend you go buy a copy. Or check one out from the library. So when we look at it, there's a paper written a few years ago by Richard McEwen, who's a hydrologist at the University of Maryland. He helped develop TR55 many years ago, a tool that we often use. And it has seven or eight aspects of how smart growth could maybe be looking at hydrology. And if you see that it's control runoff at the micro watershed or small scale level, look at the hydrologic processes of recharge, runoff. Maintain headwaters receiving streams as best possible. Maintain buffer zones. Control the spatial pattern of hydrologic storage, meaning we don't want to move drainage sheds too much off where they are. Control upland flow velocities or watershed timing. And control watershed timing and peak rates. Now, when we go to slide 28, what we know about codes and ordinances. I think one of the challenges in urban areas is that we're kind of stuck. We have lots of techniques, end of pipe, which I think in many cases are ended because we're not going to be able to use because we can't essentially have land to do them. A lot of time, I think, site development, BMPs, because of either the timing, location, or coordination, may not essentially protect our watershed. Policies of segregation where we take a look at keeping sensitive environmental areas pristine, whereas we let large-scale development happen or hydrologic impacts happen immediately next to them. So to do this, I think we have to really look at our codes and ordinances. Most of our codes and ordinances are developed on property rights, things like setbacks, green space, and we don't really have functional watershed elements based into the code. So if we have a green area, can we make it function hydrologically? Do we have accounting-based requirements, such as have X cubic feet or a certain rate that's applied generically across a watershed for stormwater control, rather than performance-based? We need to really have an adaptive management approach. So if we look at our regulations, I mean, many of our understanding of best management practices are things that were done 30 years ago. We're still looking at results and performance from a generation ago, and we're using them. So we really need to have our approach where we can adapt and really respond to what happens in the watershed. And so to do this, we not only have to look at site BMPs, but we have to really expand and look at the impacts on the watershed level. So with that, I think we're going to take a quick break, which would move us to slide 29.
Keep the phone. Copies, everyone. The phone lines now. Do we have people on the telephone that would like to ask a question to Neil? I'm going to read Neil a question that was submitted by Christopher in New York online. The tactics they are using in Central New York.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me? This is Donna Dunaway.
Okay.
I have a question for Neil, which is, could he give us an example of how you would write a performance-based ordinance or guideline versus an accounting-based one? That seems like it'd be kind of difficult.
Now you're making me think a little bit, but I think, for example, if you said reduce flows down, like say something like suspended solids to 5 milligrams per liter, or if you said provide X cubic feet of storage, rather than saying, and so the person designing the site would essentially have their choice of management practices, structural, non-structural, to achieve that. So if the government or local government could decide and say this practice, for example, assigns a certain value, we could start to really address things that way.
Yeah, we have one more question here.
I'm wondering if the city where I live were to start requiring developers to meet these kinds of sort of performance-based development requirements, would those property developers be able to find a ready supply of engineering experts who could help them figure this out, or would they have to like come to Prince George's County to find the one and only person on the planet?
Well, I wish that was true because I had been retired a long time ago. But I think as we get a little along in the presentation, sometimes I have to say when someone says engineering and expert, there's a big word in there that I'm not sure it always matches up, because usually in consulting, lots of people are experts at everything, particularly when there's money involved. But I think there's... I think there's a lot of people that are really starting to do this throughout the country, and actually I have a couple examples out of Seattle where people are really doing a great job figuring this out. So I think right now we're at this stage where you're getting people starting to be familiar with it, and I'm going to show you some examples. Like I said, I wanted to show some things that we didn't do, but lots of people throughout the country are starting to figure this out. Now, there's two sides of this equation. One is that you have local government regulatory agencies that have ways of doing things that they've done for quite some time. So trying to get this done and implemented and allowable by the local codes can take a tremendous amount of effort and really can require somebody to be really a true leader and champion. And I think that's happened in many places, especially out in the Northwest and the Midwest, where LID is really, and the Northeast, starting to take off. So I think there's going to be, especially with LID, there's going to be lots of failures, I think, over the next couple of years, because when I hear a lot of times people talk about their designs, and I'm like, what are you doing? But I think that things will adjust and we'll get moving along pretty good.
All right. Now, we have Christopher in New York has submitted a question online. He says one of the tactics they are using is a treat-in-place method with the use of 3/8 of an inch crushed glass. This offers not only a sustainable and low-cost treatment, but provides a natural attenuation of pollutants of concern. Are other people using similar methods?
You just stole some of my thunder because actually that's what we wanted to do as a pilot project using recycled glass as an aggregate. So one of the long-term things is, and what we're moving towards, I think, is how you can use materials, for example, recycled materials in many of these. So we look at kind of the whole big picture. Now, that's a big step for many people, especially when you're talking about specifications, contracting, just understanding how materials work. But I think there's a huge potential, and about 10 or 15 slides from now, I'm going to show you some things that I think that we can start to use for that.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and meet the group, Neil, and then we'll go ahead and move on to slide number 30.
We'll see you back. Now, let's kind of define LID technology, and I'd like to highlight a couple of things here. Those are all really great questions, by the way. So first let's look at kind of the five major components that we've been working around. Conservation, which we talked a little bit about. Minimization, strategic timing, integrated management practices, or these source control BMPs, and then finally pollution prevention. So first, in conserve natural areas. And like I said, we want to look at functional conservation. So, for example, many indicators of stormwater quality, for example, have been based on imperviousness. And I think one of the things that we look at is really change in land cover. So Chris Smith, Bob Pitt, a bunch of folks have really looked at the impact of compacting soil because in many cases, this can be almost as dramatic, removing trees, as pavement areas. So if you look on the subdivision at the left, you can see it's wooded, and it probably doesn't have a big impact. And you can look at the one on the lower right and say, well, the trees have all been removed. But if the subdivision on the left, for example, had roof leaders connected to driveways that connected to a storm drain system and they all went in one place, essentially you could have yourself a small shopping center impacts of that. Whereas if you look at on the right, maybe if these are disconnected roof leaders, open swales, drainage that's dispersed, you may have a much less hydrologic impact. Moving on to slide 32. And we look at site fingerprinting. So one of the things we talk about is, you know, if you go to many subdivisions, people want the trees. So large-scale developers may take all the trees down and then replant them. Can we grade these sites, especially in urban areas where we have much more scrutiny, to have less of an impact on wooded areas? So, for example, in many places of the country, you couldn't put the trees, keep the house right next to the trees, or even have that quote-unquote steep slope next to the trees. Now, we're not talking about just going wild here with this stuff. We still want to have, on slide 33, we want to do things that are reasonable when we look at vegetation management. Another key element on slide 34, where we can and we have open areas, let's try and use green space to our best advantage. Disperse drainage, things like swales work very well. Save headwater areas, maintain flow paths, and maximize sheet flow or concentrated runoff. Moving to 35, what we find on an LID is that we can have many, many different practices. And our work that we just completed with WERF, what we did is we started classifying BMPs into their functional, really their hydrologic and hydraulic functions and processes. And by doing this, in this categorization, we can alter these things as long as they keep the same tenets or concepts. Now, if you said 5 years ago you were doing a green roof, people would say, okay, maybe you just have an old roof and mold started growing on it. But there's been a tremendous interest on 36 slide in green roofs, and this is something designed by Charlie Miller of Roofscapes, and is one of really the pioneers of green roofs in this country. And he's done some really incredible things. And actually, we worked with Charlie in Florida. We did the first subtropical green roof, believe it or not. And it withstood the last hurricane that went down there. It was interesting during that one of the building code people were worried that the green roof would be projectiles during the large storm. Charlie put some netting on that, and it seemed to have held up really well. So green roof technology, and it's a very, I guess, popular thing, and it has lots of great potential and benefits. Now, people ask always, such as on slide 37, do green roofs leak? Well, this is a picture in Europe of ponding on a green roof. I just put that little wet, could use that for wetlands mitigation. I don't think the core is quite ready for that. But we can design these things with high quality. But the problem is maybe more that we have to take these and do these in massive large-scale construction. And if any of you have been in the construction industry, you know that that can be the bang-to-fit philosophy still works in many places. So with that, on slide 38, just a real quick, are common, these arrows indicate drainage patterns. And if we conventionally take the water and put it into a storm drain system in a pond and it's decentralized, well, if we had original runoff going towards a stream that might be, near where it says efficiency, we'd kind of lost that groundwater flow, and we may end up starving that stream even though we hold some of that volume for an extended period of time off to the right. So what we want to do is try and keep that energy and that kind of flow regime and the small-scale storage infiltration filtering in place. Now, some examples that we've worked on, I just want to highlight these. Let's go to slide 40. And they really run the gamut from demonstration of technology to really large-scale institutional. When we first started, we gave a presentation on our first grant, and some Navy folks were there down the Anacostia. And they said, we have some stormwater issues, and we'd like you to come on board and do some pilot projects. This is slide 41. Now, the Navy is a very unique, DOD is a very unique group, and I've done quite a bit of work before that. And so they really have to look at things not just using a cookbook approach. They really have some very specific environmental and stormwater concerns. Now, when we were told to go to the Navy Yard on slide 42, there's about 8 or 9,000 people that work at the Navy Yard in Washington, and there are 3,000 parking spaces. So they said, you can do whatever you want, but if you lose a parking space, you're gone. So here we did a bioretention cell between some older parking areas, and these parking lots were very large, so we could slip in a couple of these. And the slide on the left shows this after planting. Now the slide, and it looks really nice. And we didn't put any trees because it was a security concern. Now the slide on the right is when we had about 20 inches of rain about 3 years ago, and during a drought. Now somebody decided to put a stalk of corn in there. And I always say it's the nicest stalk of corn on the East Coast that year because it was constantly being watered. But you can see the plants are kind of ratty looking. And actually this site is about 6 years old. It's never been maintained. And it still works very well. It still filters stormwater. So we get a very high level of performance out of it without any true maintenance. And so even though the landscape might look that great, from a functional standpoint, it really works well. Well, now the screen just died. Okay, so it's just loading up very slowly. Slide 43. You want to hear if people can see that? Or?
No, just keep going.
Okay, and from that effort, really we developed this LID manual with the Navy, and when you think about it, this is a DOD-sponsored design manual on stormwater, and I think there's lots of good stuff. You can download that, and there are lots of good lessons for non-DOD areas. We're having a little technical difficulty here. Now, some of the results of that on slide 44, there's actually a nice partnership between EPA and Naval District Washington that's really doing some, an ad hoc kind of group, doing some training and outreach and really partnering on how to get sustainable site design. We just finished up a training session with them. DOD. But, you know, those kind of efforts, those kind of partnerships, and really DOD is using this throughout the country. We're actually doing some really interesting research projects on BMP. So it really spurred a lot from not only compliance, but from resource management. Now, we did some training with the Corps a few years back talking about this, and one of the regulators was very interested. In the approach, and he brought us into a project called Central Park, and not Central Park, New York, but Central Park, Virginia, which I think is on slide 45, probably one of the biggest tourist attractions on the East Coast. If you've ever been there, it's kind of big box heaven. But we kind of presented these concepts to the developer, and the developer's engineering team kind of looked at us and said, well, you guys are snake oil salesmen. This is going to cost us a ton of money. But we'll give it to our engineer and let him work it out. Well, they took these concepts, and what they found out is within maybe $5,000 or $10,000 a site, and these were fairly big sites. They took the Taco Bell and the Walmart. I'm not endorsing any of these, and all the different people that would want to be in big box heavens, and they made the designs work. So with that, it got into their permit. We're working with Target and a couple other big boxes now. And Dakota Soil Water Conservation District in Minnesota come up with some templates and design for this. And you can see here, here's even, I don't know where this IKEA is, somebody sent me this slide, 47, a green parking lot. This parking lot will probably last much better than some of the products that you could buy there than mine. Just kidding. They make good stuff. So, in 48, just to show you how some of these studies and concepts work, this is from a NFWIP, or National Fish and Wildlife Grant, with the Bay Program, where we looked at urban areas. This is a HOTE 6 project, which is a urban redevelopment. Now, where they go into kind of sponsored or project housing, and a developer makes a proposal where he provides mixed use and the same amount of housing, and can use multi-use, such as retail and office. Now, this is a 120-acre site, so figure the impact on 48 that can have. So we looked at this site, and some of the things we actually used the Prince George's County on 49 LID model, and we looked at how to model the results and what the effectiveness of that was. Now, one of the kind of impediments you talk about with LID is how do you express these the results of really distributed controls, because most of our stormwater is based on lump sum single event. So we've worked, for example, with Milwaukee, a metropolitan sewer district. We developed a model for them that really combines TR55, which is a common end-of-pipe model, with a spreadsheet. And lots of we've worked with University of Florida and also Oregon State on how to modify SWIM and EPA to look at this. So in many cases, we have legacy models where we have to work with local governments so they can kind of understand the concepts. It might not always be ideal, but, for example, it gets us on the same page. Now, I really wish to have claimed credit for slide 50, but one of the results of showing this is that DC's has a combined sewer system, and as part of the long-term control plan, WASA, which is the sewer authority, said, hey, if we have to disconnect in the combined system and then reconnect the storm sewer, it costs us a lot of money, maybe $5,000 or $6,000 a house. So what happens if we gave grants for people to do bioretention, rain gardens, on their own homes, and change the plumbing code, which required everybody to connect up to the system? And they found that they could do this for maybe $1,000 or $2 cheaper. So they could give, they're planning, I think, on giving grants as a pilot. And not only does this reduce their burden, their long-term maintenance and construction, but it also helps improve property values by the appearance. So pretty cool and a nifty concept, because I think one of the things that we have to really look at in urban areas is the responsibility for stormwater management that we're going to have. We've been working for many years on sustainable transportation issues. And if you look on the left, that little graded area is actually a tree box filter that filters stormwater. It's on slide 51. And this is really kind of a takeoff on a concept of, if you look at kind of trenchless or, excuse the name, the Cornell University has developed on using essentially a large trench with stone and topsoil to kind of help trees grow better. But we have worked with a couple groups of using either bioretention or these proprietary devices to filter runoff. So this can really fit into the streetscape. We've done some work with Maryland State Highway Administration on slide 52. This is a project we did with the University of Maryland. Now, here you can see this is an older area. Actually, this is, I tell people, my ancestral home where my dad grew up. It's right next to the District of Columbia. It's the other Mount Rainier. Our Mount Rainier was first, by the way, for the folks on the left. And what do you do? One of the big issues with looking especially at retrofits is the disruptiveness of putting controls in. There's a really neat study in Griffin, Georgia, NevTech study, Environmental Technology Verification program, that they looked at when they tried to construct large-scale retrofits. Just the size of devices was a problem, relocation of power lines, disruption. So in this technology, we essentially modified the sand filter, and we put all kinds of neat cocktails of materials in slide 53, where we did a precast box. We don't have to relocate utilities because they're all 3 feet or deeper here. Salt cut, trench this out, put it in, and be done with it. So we can do this in a very short period of time. And you can see here it kind of blends this gutter filter right into the landscape. Now, these have been in place for a couple of years, and they're not maintained a lot, maybe once a year or so, and we're still getting a very high level of performance. And that's on slide 54. One thing on slide 55 is we just finished working with DDOT, DC DOT, on the Anacostia Water Fund. Now, the Anacostia Water Fund is a really neat project. It's, I think, about $6 or $7 billion was anticipated to be spent on the renovation and rehabilitation of the waterfront, the Anacostia. And we got LID into the transportation master plan and developed some design standards and details that can be put into this. Finally, in transportation, and I think oftentimes we focus on post-construction, on slide 56, impacts, but during construction, we can have tremendous impacts. I think that slide's on time. Temporary uses can have a significant impact, especially when we build roads and things that take a long period of time. The slide on the left shows, for example, a compost sock rather than a silt fence, and helping to reestablishment. That's out of Texas DOT. They've done some great work with sediment erosion control. And on the right, we find that we have many temporary uses. Now, this is essentially a project that GSA bought us into, and we worked with the D.C. government because this is the federal center was a large-scale impervious area. And as part of the development, what we did is we put in temporary stormwater management. So in most urban areas, we can find large parking areas, large areas of the city that may exist only for a few years. And what we did is we designed essentially a bioretention swale, and it hasn't been completed, that kind of light tan area. And the gravel in front dissipates the energy. So for a very cheap amount, we take this specialized soil mix in plants, which can really high-rate biofilter the stormwater before it gets into the river. Please go to greenhighways.org on slide 57 and register. I think we're really a group of folks through Region 3 and Fed Highway and public-private partnership are really looking at kind of market-driven approaches to recycling, to stormwater management, to trading. And it's going to be a really neat effort. We've got lots of interest. There'll be a conference next month in College Park. And one of the things, like I said, we're really looking towards watershed and bringing a lot of things like brownfields, a lot of very interesting things into the design of transportation systems. The WERF project on page 58, which I mentioned, we really looked at what are the tenants to bring LID into CSO control plan. We're about to begin phase two, I believe, early next year. We're going to really look at the planning aspects. The first part, we really looked at how these controls can work. If you go to slide 59, you can see kind of our first outcomes. We're looking at the methods, analyzing the technical issues, and evaluating costs, ancillary benefits, and coming up with some initial protocols. Now, on slide 60, this is the University of Maryland College Park, one of my alma maters. And here you can see we took two bioretention cells. We did this with the University of Maryland. And are monitoring these black plastic, these are lines, so we can monitor the inflow and outflow from the systems and change the mixes and the plant materials and look at the different results. And this drains about an acre of total parking. Comes in here. And to my surprise, this has been here about 2 years, and no one has stolen the samplers yet after a ball game. We'll see at the tech game on Thursday what happens. So just a close-up. And what happens here, you can see on slide 61, is this is a pretty heavy rain event, and the water is still getting filtered through. And if you look just on cell A on the left, you can see all the coarse stuff just filtering out, and the rest really being captured in the mulch and plant materials. There's an underdrain to these, which we recommend in the designs, so the flow can go out. Now, for many years, people looked at bioretention as only a water quality device, but let me just show you the effect, which is pretty dramatic, on slide 62 of just one event. The blue is the inflow hydrograph, and you can see how it rains here. We get these very sharp peaks, high amount of volume, especially all totally paved areas. And the green and the red show delayed peaks and very small runoff volume. So just the effect of placing these, the timing, and you can see we're not absorbing a tremendous amount of water because these are lined, can have a very significant impact, just a sponge effect of the soil and the plants. Now, what happens during a big event, this is during Isabel, so many hurricanes, I can't remember these, but last 2003, and you can see here the blue, the input, and the green and the red, we still have very good effect. And I didn't include a water quality slide here,
but our metals removal oil and grease is still very effective. Now with that, my voice needs a little break, so we'll take some questions.
Okay, I'm going to unmute the phone line. Give a chance for the people on the telephone to ask questions. Does anyone on the telephone have questions? Anyone from the telephone line like to ask a question?
Yeah, hi, this is Steve Donahue in EPA Region 3. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I was interested in this, you mentioned a Milwaukee model that combines PR55 with some of the lid techniques. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because that's a big issue with locally in my township.
A couple things. That model, it really just looks at the volume control, that maybe the initial runoff, it's not really routing it such as TR55, so, but it includes green roofs, technique. We've actually did some green roofs, fire retention, and permeable pavement. And I think it's on the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewer District site, or if not, I believe it's somewhere buried in our website, and if you send me an email, I can get that to you. That's all public domain stuff. But they're very much a volume based because it's combined sewer, but they like the TR55 approach, and that's how that has worked. There's also some guidance that's going to come out. Richard McKean's actually working on a few things. He should have some papers published, especially on green roofs and how you look at that for TR55, because, like I said, we're still in many places using single event stormwater models.
Does that include, capture some of the things that are missing right now in that model, which is the surface area and evapotranspiration and all? Like surface area, like tree cover, and does it get into that or no?
No, it's still just using kind of the broad-based kind of initial abstract. I don't want to get too technical there, but if you've got me an email later, I should get back with you. But there are some people working on those efforts and really looking at developing curves and regional curves. I think you're going to see over the next couple of years, if the funding's there, hopefully, where we can kind of meld the two, because we've had to do that. I don't have a slide of it today, but, for example, we've just completed a project in Virginia where we looked at using the SWIM model, which is continuous, and had to match it up with TR55. So we looked at the LID techniques and calibrated to NRCS methods.
Okay, thank you, Neil. Does someone else from the cell phone like to ask the question?
Yes. I was very interested in the CAPR project in D.C. and about the exact strategies you use. This is Todd Lieberman calling from Bank of America. But I'm interested in some of the strategies you use for stormwater management with that project and some of the work that maybe you had done in informing the decisions that the developer made about choosing which strategies were feasible and which ones were used.
Okay, that's another downloadable thing off our site. From our site staff. But essentially, we came up with some concepts, and we worked with the Uber Brandis. It was with the
DWC.
Yeah, and we kind of sat down with the developer and said, here's some concepts. Here's how they can be used. So we developed some templates of how they could be combined in what we were given information their kind of design would look like generally. And so we sat down with the developer and the engineer, and the engineer said, yeah, we can design it. Yes, it's not going to impact the look that we want and make that work. Now, if you hold on for about 30 more slides, there's a really nice project in the Pacific Northwest that I'm going to show that's actually built using these principles.
Okay.
But I think the important thing here is that, in development, it's been my experience, because I used to do a lot of that, is that, developers and builders have patterns that they like to use or styles, and can you fit these into it? We just, we're working actually on this Metro West project with Pulte on developing some of those in Fairfax. So that's kind of the critical thing, and that's the adaptability of LID.
Okay. And the download is on your website?
Somewhere in there. Our website's getting crowded with a lot of stuff, but...
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
One of the questions that was written in is, how do you incorporate woodland ID without changing the hydrologic roles?
Well, I think a couple things is, you know, the change in, can we design sites, obviously we have a template or a development or we have to get a certain number of lots, you know, can we keep kind of our flow patterns and, you know, if we're doing reforestation or afforestation, how can we best kind of use the landscape to help absorb some of the runoff? So, you know, I guess my point is that, you know, for example, we, in Maryland, we have pretty strong tree conservation ordinances, but a lot of times it's just meeting this accounting standard where if you have to replace or put in, you know, 5 acres of trees, it may not have to really perform the same function as making the habitat contiguous or, you know, helping to absorb some of the runoff.
Okay, great. And one last question. Chris in Nevada wants to know, what is the media that makes up the biocell?
Okay. Sorry, I probably skipped over that a little bit. But what a bioretention cell is essentially it's a high-rate biological filter. And we know from wastewater that biological systems are our most efficient stormwater, most efficient for treatment. So essentially it's made up with some kind of a sand or glass or aggregate mixture that usually has a little bit of a charge so it attracts some metals to it. But that acts as a high-rate filter. Then we add some organic material and usually in the form, we like to use mulch or something that doesn't degrade very quickly, and then a real high-grade quality topsoil for plant growth, and plus it also acts in some of the filtering. So it's a mix of about half sand and the rest of organic material in the mulch. Once again, on our website, we have some of that stuff that you can take a look at, but I think it's really important to get the materials right. I've seen people put just in-situ topsoil or high clay content, and they end up making muck holes. So when done right and correctly, these really have a lot of potential in stormwater. Very small area can control a lot of runoff.
All right, we're going to be moving on in just a second. I'd like to let everyone know that we're going to be bringing in another speaker from outside, so appreciate everyone's cooperation in keeping their stuff quiet because we're going to be able to hear everybody if anybody else is speaking.
Okay, thanks. Now I'd like to really show you some kind of regional applications because when people say it won't work here, I want to show them where it is really working and there's some great stuff around the country because I really don't want to talk for 2 hours and you probably don't want to hear me talk for 2 hours. I asked Doug Bish, I was asked, can you get a developer that's doing this? And I think there's lots of developers throughout the country. Actually, we've worked with National Association of Home Builders Research Center, and we've done lots of outreach, and I think we're going to go down and to Tennessee Valley Authority and do the same thing, and out in California in a couple weeks, yay, because it's cold here, to start looking at this. And I've known Doug Bish. He works for Williamsburg Environmental Group, the development consultant, and Doug used to work with the state of Virginia and their water quality group. And he's really, he wants to talk about how to get this stuff done and right. And Doug is, we've kind of informally worked with him on some stuff and shared lots of ideas. And Doug has really been great at pushing LID and stormwater in the state. And he's going to show you an example of a project, Haymont. I know this project's been on the books and the table for development for quite a year, a few years, and now it's finally coming to fruition. When Doug showed me all the slides here, I was just amazed at all the great stuff that they're putting into this development. So with that, Doug,
all right.
You got your 15 slides.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, Neil. I appreciate the introduction. Can everyone hear me okay? Anyone? Can you hear me, Neil?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, all right, just double-checking there. I'm Doug Bish. As Neil said, I'm a water resource engineer with Williamsburg Environmental Group. I did want to say we've got my name up on the introductory slide 66, but by no means am I even to be granted any of the majority of the credit for this project. This is a collaborative effort with a variety of different consultants. The project's been in the planning stages for 20 years before I even got out of college.
We're having a hard time hearing the speaker.
Okay, turning the volume up. Can you hear me a little bit better now?
Can you get closer to the microphone?
Can you hear me a little better now?
No.
Hello?
No, we can't.
Okay, keep going, please. Keep trying.
All right. Again, I'll speak up a little bit louder. The team that's assembled here today, we were hoping to have John Clark. John Clark is the master developer for the Haymount project. He is with the John A. Clark Company. John was unavailable, but Shelley May is a more than capable replacement. She is the environmental manager for the entire project. They have a staff of about 10 individuals on site that are responsible for managing the development, directing some of the environmental efforts, and coordinating their multi-pronged approach to conservation and sustainable development. We've also got Scott Blossom here, who's a project engineer with Williamsburg Environmental, who's been doing a lot of the work. So if I can't answer questions, then hopefully the team can. Assuming everybody can hear me okay, I'm going to turn it over to Shelley to give a little bit of project background, and we will jump on to the slide 67.
Okay, the project background for Haymount Development, just an overview geographically, we are located in Caroline County, Virginia, which is just 20 minutes south of Fredericksburg. The entire project encompasses 1,800 acres. We have 3 miles of river frontage on the Rappahannock River, and the planned development encompasses 4,000 residential units, 500,000 square foot of commercial space, and 250,000 square feet of retail space. As Doug had mentioned, this development has been in the works since the mid-80s, so we're at 20 years now. The style of development is a new urbanist style, and with the new urbanist style comes responsible land use and planning. So if we go to slide 68, Haymount is really driven by responsible ecosystem management, and under that comes water quality management, nutrient management, wastewater reuse, wildlife habitat management, and forestry management. We currently have a forester contracted that manages the 800 acres of forest that we have. We're currently managing for old growth forests and also have passive recreation trails. We do have a number of wildlife corridors that connect the development, so we have full rotation of wildlife going through the entire 1,200 acres. And if we go to slide 69, really, the goals established 20 years ago, or what's laid out here, is they're still prevalent today as a sustainable ecosystem approach. We go into conservation of biological diversity, maintenance of productive capacity of the forest ecosystems, maintenance of forest ecosystems' overall health and vitality, conservation and maintenance of soil and water resources, and the maintenance and enhancement of long-term multiple socioeconomic benefits. And these came on the table 20 years ago, and these are still realistic today and the goals that we're trying to achieve in the development.
With that, I'll talk briefly about the stormwater management objectives for the site. Overall, the stormwater management criteria in the general, you know, in throughout Virginia and in the localities we're working in and the region we're working in, are not as stringent as in some areas, but this project, we've worked in some very stringent areas. This project is trying to go above and beyond the level of technology that we've implemented on pretty much any project ever. So it's really an exciting project for us as engineers, environmental consultants. We have hydrologists working on this, geomorphologists, etc. I'll just jump back here to the gentleman that had a question about an adaptive management approach. Some of the laying out the stormwater objectives for the site, the primary goals were to preserve, enhance, or restore the resources through our water management on the site, management of terrestrial and aquatic resources. And it takes that multidisciplinary approach, I think, in order to effectively accomplish that. So our goal is we want treatment at every major outfall. To the extent practical, we want 100% treatment of all of the runoff leaving the site. We want to preserve and improve the runoff quality. The majority of the development is existing agricultural fields at present time that are actively cropped. We feel we can make a significant improvement in the actual water quality leaving the site. We're using a treatment train approach that incorporates interior management practices, permeable paving surfaces, green roofs. I'll touch on that in a moment. Integrated management practices, stormwater management facilities, and resource restoration, all coupled so that at every level we can catch the water, treat it, infiltrate it, reduce the hydrograph, or get it back to pre-development conditions we are. And there's a tremendous focus on bioengineered techniques that are going to act as community amenities rather than the BMP, Big Muddy Pond acronym that I've heard thrown around. So with that, if we jump to slide 71, some of the site design techniques that have been incorporated since the early planning of the development include concentrating the development within preserved corridors. You see the bullet across from that says focus the development on the existing ag fields. At least for the first three sections, I don't believe there will be any clearing outside of the limits of the existing agricultural fields. So we've minimized any clearing required. We may have some miscellaneous for utility crossings or encroachments for clearing here and there. But for the most part, we've conserved all of the forest resources over large contiguous segments and preserved wildlife borders as well. That goes back to the functional, hydrologically functional landscape that Neil was talking about. We've maintained stream corridors, we've maintained buffers, we are restoring degraded riparian corridors, doing three tiers of vegetation throughout riparian buffers on intermittent and perennial stream systems. We've got enhanced outfall protection measures for additional energy dissipation and treatment. We've incorporated bioretention, biofiltration in open space settings, where bioretention, particularly where the soils are suitable. And overall, the site's preserved to about two-thirds of the site is preserved, and that's what the traditional neighborhood design concept, you know, compacting the development into these tight corridors and then preserving, fingerprinting it on sort of en masse is what it's allowed to do. And additionally, that reuse of on-site wastewater. I also want to speak about some of the bioengineering techniques that have been incorporated. Constructed stormwater wetland techniques are going to be incorporated at every outfall associated with at least the first two phases of the project. To the extent practicable, we're going to use wetland technologies for treatment of stormwater runoff at all outfalls throughout the development, at least where the topography and physical constraints permit. They have multiple tiers of vegetation. There's a hydrologic connection between the constructed stormwater wetlands and the existing riparian corridor. It's tied in with a comprehensive buffer riparian corridor restoration plan that includes upland landscaping and wetland landscaping and enhancement to existing resources. We perform a natural channel design on any degraded segments of the channels throughout at least the first phases of the project, incorporating channel shaping and stream structures, reconnecting the channel with the floodplain, stabilization with native species. Another note about that, I don't know that this is necessary LID, but the project, a lot of the landscape materials that are going to go into the stream restoration and potentially the wetlands components as well are being grown on site right now at the landscape nursery, which is present. So it's locally grown stock. Additionally, we're recycling some of the trees that were felled in a recent hurricane to use as some of the grade control structures, log structures, root wads, etc., in the stream restoration project. And we've identified those areas where we can take some of the felled trees. The integrated practices, the IMPs, the low impact development features. We did a suitability screening on the front end, which included natural resource mapping and analysis, evaluation of soil, slopes, floodplains, look at hydrology, pre- and post-development drainage patterns, and tried to identify areas where LID was either feasible, moderately feasible, or not feasible. In general, the not feasible, what that is more like a gradation of cost. Low cost in very feasible areas and high cost in the areas identified as not feasible. Because obviously cost is still a concern.
And Doug, would you mind just mentioning the slide numbers when you can?
Yeah, sure. I'm sorry. I would jump over to slide 73. I'm going to move on to slide 74 and then turn it back over to Shelley. The practices that we are envisioning incorporating, you can see there's a reduction of a 24 by 36 graphic with maybe 9 or 10 core techniques that we're envisioning to be used throughout the development. Those techniques are not necessarily going to be applied in each section or phase, but what we did is provided a menu coupled with this suitability screening practice.
I'm sorry, Doug General. Can I remind everybody that their phones are not on mute and that if you speak or make noise near your speaker, everyone else can hear it? Please continue, Doug.
Okay. So what we basically did is we've got the suitability screening, we've got a list of these practices. We performed a cost assessment with that so they can get a handle on this and discuss some of the benefits in future permitting. At current present standpoint, we don't have any wetland impacts associated with Phase 1A, so permits are not envisioned to be required for 404 issues or wetland stream impacts. But this is certainly something that can help you move through a permitting process. And so they're envisioning right now that green roof application, bioretention and biofiltration, it's very difficult to do it on lots because the lots are very small with the traditional neighborhood development where there's not a lot of space without other conflicts with sidewalks or utilities or driveways or et cetera. So what we're doing is we are daylighting some of the storm drain infrastructure into some of the open space areas, and we're developing area plans for these open spaces, which are going to incorporate low-impact development technology sort of in a flow split type of mode to provide some partial infiltration treatment of these areas. Another technique that will be employed throughout the project is the use of soil amendments. In a traditional neighborhood development setting, basically the entire block is compacted and constructed as a structural pad. You have very small pervious areas remaining. Rather than taking that compacted soil and laying a 2-inch sod strip over it, which is never really going to do much as far as reducing the amount of runoff, we're going to incorporate a compost soil amendment. It'll likely be composted on site. And the compost soil amendments will be deep-filled into the soil and then stabilized with vegetation to try and restore some of the soil porosity, moisture capacity, et cetera, and give some good organic substrate. Permeable pavements are going to be used. We've looked at using them in the alleyways throughout the community. At least on first phase, that's not going to happen. We're looking to potentially get some cost recovery on the sizing of the storm drainage network serving those alleyways. It's just a mountain we didn't want to have to scale at this point for first phase, but future phases, we may get cost recovery and do permeable pavements, and we think it may work out where it'll net out or be beneficial. So at present time, in large common parking areas serving some of the commercial retail uses, we're envisioning using pervious pavement or permeable overflow parking areas, et cetera. And thirdly, a number of the retail structures or community facilities have been earmarked for green roof applications ultimately, although the ultimate size, configuration, and design of those hasn't been determined yet. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Shelley, and she can talk a little bit about some of the other elements of the project and water management in general.
Okay, that puts us on slide 75, where we're going to go into the LID education program. We just started a education program here this fall that's aimed at high school students, and the idea is for them to be introduced to low-impact development and the benefits that it has to offer and also how to implement it. The program is being funded currently by the Virginia Environmental Endowment, and within the grant funding, the project scope is to provide two working sessions with teachers, workshops where we get feedback from the teachers how they would like to see this education project goal turn out. And within that, we have 6 field trips involved for children in the spring, and the main focus is high school students and also AP high school classes. So we've already started that. The ball is rolling. We've had one workshop and another workshop scheduled for next month, and then the field trips will be coming up in the spring. That takes us to slide 76, where as part of the water quality monitoring program, we will be doing chemical and biological water sampling. And we're hoping to have this real-time data collection coming in the future and posted on, hopefully the goal is to have a website set up so everyone can see this data as it's collected and coming in real-time mechanism. Also, another major important part of the water quality monitoring program is the wastewater treatment plant. We have a new innovative wastewater treatment plant design. We'll be using SBR technology. If you're not familiar with that technology, it uses aerobic and anaerobic processes for nutrient reduction. And within the wastewater treatment plant itself, we will be providing energy efficiency with our pumps and design. We're also hoping to maybe have a green rooftop on some of the SBR tanks. That is a future thought for the design. That takes us into slide 78, where we talk about water reuse. And the overall goal is to recycle the water coming out of the wastewater treatment plant. We are planning to have it engineered to have all the necessary chlorine contact and UV light that's needed to take this and transmit it back out to the community for street tree irrigation, stream augmentation, wetland enhancement, commercial building, heating and cooling, or even car washes. And with that, we go into slide 79, the reason and the vision for sustainability at Haymount. We can contribute all of these goals to John Clark. All of this is his idea, and these words come straight from him, where he mentions design with humility and acknowledge the complexity of nature, accept environmental responsibility, nurture connection between nature and the human spirit, and design with sustainability to allow for environmental technology and innovation.
All right, thank you. We have a chance for some people to ask some questions now to Doug and Shelley. One question that was submitted online, Shelley and Doug, is we need to demonstrate how you do it and how much money developers can make by building this way. Do you have specific savings and cost-benefit examples?
I think, for the low-impact development practices, I really think when you start looking at them, you've got to balance costs and the practicability and those other elements. I've got numbers, not necessarily from this site, but from other sites that typically the practices, in my opinion, cost significantly more than using conventional stormwater practices. Where you get the recoveries are in some of the ancillary cost recoveries that Neil was mentioning, which are ancillary from a stormwater perspective, but maybe the critical design elements for the developer, which are recovery of usable, developable area on the site, increased building footprint, increased parking area, those kind of things. I also think a time of permitting. If you're showing you're willing to do innovative things, I really think Haymount is benefiting from that tremendously, because in dealing with regulatory agencies, permitting authorities, the county, time is money to a developer. If you've got a X number of million-dollar project, you're paying debt service on that every day. So every day it's typically costing you thousands of dollars for every day that your stuff is not built. Well, if things move through the process much more efficiently because you're willing to step out of the box and do some of these practices, that number can be quantified. And we typically try to do that with our developer clients in the early phases and say, well, we think you could shorten your permitting time frame by 3 months if you do this, this, and this. And 3 months to them, it ends up being a very real and definable value in hard cash. So that's my perspective. I don't know if, Shelley, you've seen other cost recoveries that might be.
Well, I don't think that it's just cost, but it's also the environmental ethic. I mean, if you listen in depth to this presentation, it's more than just a cost-driven mechanism. It's, the thought process behind designing responsibly.
Okay, thank you very much. Does anyone from the telephone want to ask a question to Doug or Shelley?
Yeah, I'd like to know if Doug's done any calculation. It's Kevin from Toronto. I'd like to know if Doug's done any calculation of the value of land saved by the use of on-site detention facilities, particularly rain barrels or rain gardens. Do you have a calculation of available land costs avoided for big ponds?
Hey, Kevin. How you doing, man?
Good, thanks.
I can give you some numbers from some of the other sites. Like, I'd rather not. You make estimates on the pre-construction side or during construction, and, you know, I hate giving those numbers out. But I've got some other constructed sites where I can give you hard numbers for the retail space that they got and what the actual value of that was, the net value of that was to the developer. Increased parking area, you know, where we've used cisterns, rain barrels, distributed retention practices, et cetera. So I'd be happy to offline to get you some of those numbers. If
okay.
You
can.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate Shelley and Doug's participation. I'm going to go ahead and mute everybody, and then we're going to go back to Neil and pick up on slide number 81.
Thanks, Doug. That was great, and it's good to hear the whole thing going on with that. On a couple of just on the costing, I know EPA is working on some costing for low impact development and looking at the comparison. But one of the most important things here is that the way we've been asking costs of stormwater questions has been very narrowly focused. You know, we say it's $1 a foot or $2 a foot. And we say, well, how much does 20 acres of this cost? And I think the cost equation is much more complex, especially in urban areas where essentially we've we're past the life cycle, the effective use of many of our storm drain systems, so we have to really focus on rebuilding infrastructure and trying to conserve that. It's a tremendous cost that I think we're faced with. Now we're going to take a whirlwind tour across the country, and someone was asking the Northwest. Well, Puget Sound Water Quality Action Team is really, PSAT, WASHC.gov, is really a leader and really been promoting this. I remember I came out to Washington State, Seattle, about 5 years ago, and they asked me to give a talk at a transportation conference. And their AV system wasn't working or whatever, and so I had about a five-minute talk where I was supposed to have an hour. And just some of the initial conferences said, wow, you have to come back here next year, and these are really cool. We started this, and all of a sudden they put on an LID conference, and they had several hundred, about 300 or 400 people, and it's really taken off out there. And this group has really been essential in as a clearinghouse and promoting that technology. They have actually an LID manual, I think, Curtis Hinman, who's with one of the soil conservation districts. And I think as one of the prime authors of that. And I think it's really in Pierce County. Important to note that I think there's a tremendous potential in stormwater with the soil conservation districts, as I'll show you. But essentially, they've come up with some guidance. They've worked with partners, Chris May at Washington, and a couple other groups, and really helped the local governments do demonstrations and help with 319 and help in their ordinance and code development. Now, how do one of these developments look? Now, this Hope 6 development. So we also came, Seattle Public Utilities brought us out, and we met with them on a project, the Hope 6 project, and this is done by SBR. This is slide 84. And they took some of the concepts that we developed from our study, and they're putting this in the ground. And this is a big project. I think it's about 80 or 90 acres of Hope 6, if we move on to the next slide. So in this, it's going a little bit slow here. But, for example, using porous pavement in the street. I know porous, Portland, for example, is using permeable pavement blocks. So using that in the design, you can see how these fire retention cells, excuse me, on slide 86, you can see they're just lining the streets or curved or open sections, and these are really incorporated into the design to help absorb and filter runoff in a very highly dense area. And the same thing on 87, permeable pavement sidewalks and streets in a very small urban section. So on slide 88, even the splash blocks have some design. So really paying attention to detail down to the very small level. So still keeping in the Northwest, Seattle C Streets project. And this is really a phenomenal effort, and I've been following this, and every time I catch up with them, they've always got new stuff. This is just to illustrate typical urban, this is a combined sewer area, typical urban area, 40 or 50 foot wide street. And as part of the reconstruction of the city, if you go to slide 90, they cut the streets down to, I believe, about 14 foot width. The parking is on the sides. And it's lined with fire retention. That's me, by the way, so. And I used to say, another word, but now I'm horizontally challenged, so I'm politically correct. But if you look at the C Streets project, for example, here, not only is there less impervious area, but the windiness of this acts as a traffic calming device. And, if you go to slide 92, for example, you can see, this is just after planning, and there's some, this really doesn't do it justice because there's some great pictures here, but, this slide has been monitored. Rich Horner at UW monitored this, and essentially they had a 98% reduction in runoff volume. So someone was asking Rich, you remember, he was telling me, well, what about the water quality? He said, I didn't really bother doing the water quality because since there was no runoff volume, we really, and so we can, like I say, bring things back to the natural hydrologic condition of not really having, of having minimal runoff in the site. Now, from that, it was great because they didn't stop there, and I think there's maybe a dozen or so new projects in the city of this, and they've been learning from that. They came up with ways to make things less expensive, standardized design, if you look on, say, 93. But what's also interesting is on 94, slide 94 and 95, hopefully you can see this, we're going to look, they looked at such as the traditional approach to rebuilding the street. And essentially the cost was expensive because when you have centralized systems, you have large pipes. But in option 2 and 3, where they used the decentralized control, the pipes were smaller, the excavation less, and maybe some of the disturbance was less. But there's also, and do-nothing approach, you can see O&M is the green. There also is that there's increase in home values in some of these, and savings from the loan, and I think that's because the cost of the project is less. So people are starting to look at these as more of an asset management approach, or, you know, not only the approach to the city and the cost savings to the city, but the potential improvement to the homeowner. And moving on to 95, for example, you know, the present value or the value of that, the cost of doing that rehabilitation. So hopefully I've given those slides justice, but if you go to the C Streets, just type that in the net, you should be able to get more of the information. Now let's move on over to the Lake Coast, and this is a project that I've been following for quite some time. This is up in near Boston, and this is a courtesy of GeoSyntec, who's worked with the state and also this town. It's a small one of these kettle lakes here. You can see off to the right on slide 96 where the town beach is. And one of the issues here is the water quality is bad because of the runoff from the street that goes into near the town beach. So they worked with getting grants, using some financing, using kind of residents to chip in, and design a whole bunch of LID practices. For example, here is on slide 97 is just a small-scale bioretention. So you can see here on where it says Littleton, Mass, to the right there, there's a little cutout where the water gets into the bioretention cell. And slide 98, this is a much more engineered solution, but here was a steep slope and essentially a bio swale with some permeable pavement blocks on the left on 98. So there's a whole series of projects here, and with a whole bunch of different funding mechanisms that I thought was great. And I didn't show this slide, but it's leveraged. There's about four or five sources that really make this work. Now, moving over to the middle of the country, this is in Minnesota, or Minnesota, I'm not quite sure how to get that quite right, but this is Jay Riggs from Dakota Soil Water Conservation District. This is another conservation district on 99, where they're looking at assisting local voters. And here, you can see here the curb cut as part of a street retrofit and a bioretention design. What's neat, and this is out of Maplewood, is that these designs are different choices designed by landscape architects here, such as a sunny border garden on slide 100, a native garden, a butterfly garden. So believe it or not, the engineers let the landscape architects actually design something. And I think that's part of the long-term success of these, is having them look good so people get buy-in. If they look good when they're put in, not just the two shrubs and three trees or whatever that the developer does, by investing in that, you can have a lot of curb appeal or bang for the buck. Moving to slide 101, how do these work in cold weather? And you can see here, and I think there's some Edmonds Oliver, there's a lot of groups that are starting to study that. Well, they did a paired watershed study on this project. What's interesting is that much of our BMP research is just focused on one BMP, for example, a pond, or and we really have to start moving into larger scale neighborhood watersheds, really look at how these things work. So when we talk about will this work in cold weather, essentially these sites are about 12 acres apiece, one uncontrolled, which is called the control volume or the green, and the red is where all these fire retention cells were put in. I don't think it takes too much technical expertise to look at the reduction in flow volume and resultant pollutant loads and energy downstream between the green and the red. So I think that's a really successful project. Okay, if we go down south to slide 103, this is a conservation design industrial park. This is currently designed out of the University of Alabama and TVA and a group, and by Bob Pitt and his students, and I'd say Bob Pitt is the hardest working man in stormwater, and he's done a lot of great research, and I can't remember Alabama, you're going to have to remind us about which Alabama university it is there that you're at, but there's a lot of great research that he's done, especially on soils and stormwater, and hopefully somebody will find his website there. But looking at 104 on some of these techniques, filtering, modified swales, wet detention ponds, and looking at the effect of these, for example, on the slide 105 shows with percent reduction of either volume or sediment on the left and rainfall depth, and this is what they're predicting as far as the effectiveness of these practices. Okay, back on slide 106, we'll go to the San Francisco Bay Area, and this is started at the source and BASMA.org. Jill Bicknell was kind enough to send me this. Some basic design components. It's very similar to the LID stuff with the West Coast flavor. And Santa Clara. So, like I said, this is, and I can't really, being in California, I think there's lots of interest, especially at university training and local government level, where we are going to start to see LID being used in the regulatory environment and the source water. And, for example, the California State Water Control Board, I think with NEMO, is about to begin a kind of an educational process of 108. There's a brochure that they're going to put out. And I think these are very important, this outreach, because you need to give this to policy and decision makers, all this nice technical stuff, in a very clear cut and concise manner that's understandable, because they're the people that are going to vote on these codes and ordinances. And if you can get that the decision makers asking why we can't or why we need to do this, that's really critical in the momentum process, and also the developers. Okay, so with that, let me just get caught up. Just a couple of slides left. Kind of some of the lessons learned, and I think some of the things we should start considering is, first, on slide 109. I think someone asked about adaptive management approach, and I know DOD uses this a lot, and things like environmental management systems, and really looking at stormwater as potentially an economic asset rather than a declining value. And I think there's lots of potential, as you can see with LID, because we can not only enhance the landscape, enhance aesthetics, we can roll these things into programs such as road rebuilding or urban redevelopment. So there's lots of potential to use them. But in order to do that, we have to get credit. I know in working in one county here in Northern Virginia, and, you know, Green Roof's essentially not getting the credit for much in the way of stormwater quantity. So, you know, why, I mean, maybe out of goodness of someone's heart, or they think it's great institutionally, which happens quite a bit. But for, by and large, they're not going to get done if they're not going to get the stormwater credit for many of these. So part of our regulations, like I say, should really give credit and level the playing field for innovation. I think Doug and a couple other people talked about is that, you know, if you can do innovative things and maybe monitor them, I mean, we invest so little much money in monitoring right now, maybe the development community, and I think they will do that for expediting plans or giving them credit, will start to help us monitor these, because there's certainly not a lot of public money out to do monitoring. And then, you know, we really base ourselves on minimum standards and kind of cookbook approaches, and I think we really have to start asking ourselves, are those really protecting our watersheds? And then when we look at sustainability, because I think that's one of the things we're moving to, is many of the kind of things like LEED, for example, may not be good examples, because we may say, okay, we get a point or two for doing something LEED. If you're not familiar, you can go to the U.S. Green Building Council's website. But we maybe just designed to meet that criteria and maybe not what the best use of the site are. And I think for a lot of this to work, if we make the economics work, people will put these in. And what are the true costs and values to the community of stormwater? Many, I think, issues that can be hotly contested in the environmental groups, but you can find the general public not really that interested or concerned immediately about stormwater, but they're certainly concerned about the way their streets look, the way their community looks, and by doing a lot of this LID stuff, we can kind of meld that in there and accomplish both. Okay, but the world is not always perfect in that we go to 110. I think we still have lots of challenges and unknown. First, with all our BMP systems, what's the level of performance? What happens? I mean, many of our BMP manuals, for example, cite 50% efficiency or 10% load reduction, but we don't really know how these are working over a long period of time. I think things like the ASC database will bring that out. But I think what I've seen, my experience in LID, is that many of these things are not maintained, because nothing really is maintained in the real world, still have a very high level of performance. And then operations or maintenance. One of the things that was interesting, just story to me, is that when we presented this to some people in the district, they were talking about the high maintenance costs, because they said, well, these things are so efficient, they can really remove a lot of the pollutants that were passed through the system. And, you know, we sat at a table and it was like, well, this is really what we want to do, right? If we want to move pollutants, and we're putting fine-grained things in large, coarse bottles and cans, well, it's going to accumulate and we have to remove it. So one thing is, how are we going to pay for these efficient systems? Inspection is another issue. How do we know when things are still working or not? In many proprietary devices, it's quite hard to inspect things. And who pays for the inspection on a long-term basis? What is the long-term fate and transport of some of these pollutants? What we've been traditionally doing is taking pollutants and transporting them through the watershed and pipes and conveyance systems. But with LID, what we're trying to do is keep very low levels of pollution in one spot. So if there's a problem, we can take action, the appropriate action. And then what are the policy and the code developments? Many places are just getting their phase twos underway and phase one. And then we're really talking about some very radical changes, especially if we look at maybe potential performance standards. So we've really, there's a lot of interest, but how do you change a large-scale long-term policy? And then finally, what does this, all this LID stuff do for us? Well, I think many of our end-of-pipe approaches aren't going to be valid over the next couple of years. I mean, if you look in the Washington area, we have 2 million more people coming here, and we don't have a lot of new infrastructure. So by building large-scale ponds or regional facilities, I think we're going to be very limited, especially with the high cost of land and many of the problems that we're learning that are associated with end-of-pipe facilities. We have wetlands restoration, which I think has been very effective done, and I think we can show lots of benefits. And then we have stream restoration, and not stabilization. You know, in many cases, we don't restore the hydrology, and we have a stream that we've spent hundreds of dollars a square foot, fixing, rearranging the channel, but we still don't get the biological activity of it because we've changed the flow regime. And then finally we have, in many cases, people, even though stream restoration might be a good thing, they're used to having wooded areas, and the disruption can, well, a couple projects now can cause a problem. And then finally we have uplands, or LID. And what this does is really gives us a range of options. Before LID, we really didn't have that uplands option. And now we can really look at things in the watershed context and see what is the best approach or combination of approach throughout the watershed. Okay, and with that,
we have 111 slides. And Susan said I wouldn't finish on time, but we did. So we have some time for questions.
Thank you. I'm going to go over one or two of the questions that were submitted online, Neil, and then we will take questions from the phone as well. One question is pretty simple, but Laura is in Maine, and she wants to know, how can the LID practices shown here today be adapted to smaller rural communities that typically have very limited funding?
Actually, one of our first projects with actually the Friends of the Rappahannock, which go to their website, it's FOR.org or something they've got, and actually that cost analysis is on there too from that Central Park. I think you can mine that on the website. But we worked, we went down to this place, and I did a speech, and some fellows came up to me and said, would you like to come to Warsaw? And I said, Warsaw, you guys are a long way. And he goes, no, Warsaw, Virginia. And it's a small town on the Rappahannock, and they seem like nice folks, and I like the Rappahannocks. And I went down there, and a councilman of three people, and they said, well, this sounds good because, you know, we built this pond in back of the shopping center. They had one shopping center, and everybody was complaining because the snakes from the pond came into the video rental store and was scaring people. And every shopping cart in town ended up in the pond. So they're interested because they didn't want to maintain these things. They wanted to try and make things as natural as possible and try and have the homeowners maintain things. So we worked with the FOR and got some codes and ordinances, and I think it's working pretty good. There's actually a 319, a demonstration project down there. So I think it really fits, I mean, with large communities. I know I live in Montgomery County and Maryland, and we have about 1,300 or so stormwater ponds that the county maintains. And that's a pretty big burden. I mean, maintaining a pond that might require $300,000 or $400,000 of retrofit every, you know, 10 or 15 years is a big public burden. So I think it can be done in rural communities, especially small scale, that don't have many of these resources.
Okay, one more question from our online participants is from Christopher in New York. And he says, with the promotion of rain barrels and other devices that have standing water, they've had people want to remove the structures because there's a perception of even nothing but mosquito hatcheries. What can we do to combat this misconception?
Well, actually, there's a participant here. Kevin, are you still on the... Are you going to unmute him? But I think it's riverside.org. There you go. Can you hear me? Are you there?
I'm here, Neil.
Okay, this would be a good question for you. I'm going to put the audience on the spot now because maybe you can answer that for us.
Well, a good rain barrel should have a filter system that would be approximately 200 micron mesh to control mosquitoes. Ideally, what we want to do when we design cisterns or rain barrels is just make sure that they have zero clearance input filters so that there's no open air between the water and the outside of the barrel. And what we've used in our RiverSafe rain barrel is a 200 micron mesh Nitex filter. This is a filter used for DipNet technology. So that it, you know, you've got something that's not going to rust, it's not going to mold or mildew. But by and large, in addition to that, a simple addition of something like vinegar to keep the pH off balance would serve as a deterrent to most mosquito breeding habitat.
You did?
They don't.
I guess not.
Are there other people on the telephone lines that would like to ask a question before we end today's webcast?
Yeah, this is Becky in Houston. On slide 99, the Minnesota example, I'm intrigued by the bioretention pond. Is that in the right-of-way? And is it constructed as part of the road project?
Hang on 1 second. We're bringing up slide number 99 here.
I believe that is, I can't answer you 110%, but I think if you look, I think they have the maps and everything published on their website somewhere. I'm not quite sure. We might have it linked to it, but one of the things is that these can be constructed. They have been constructed within and without the right-of-way. I thought it was interesting. I know in the Seattle, I think the landscape architect told me that they wanted to have the grass strip. They were constructing the right-of-way, but they wanted to have the grass strip next to the curb because that would make the property owner come out and cut the grass and kind of look and police around the bioretention soil. So it could be done as an easement or something within, outside of the right-of-way also.
Right. Well, that was kind of my next question. Do in situations like this, do they expect then the homeowner to take ownership kind of it and tend it? Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I mean, and I think what I've seen in these is that people start to make their own little, add their own little plants and flamingos and rocks and whatever you want to have.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, we have time for another question from the cell.
Yes, this is Mandy Techo in Region 7. We were wondering, what is Neil's website?
Oh, we're going to give all those a 10. And if everybody goes, if you're on slide number 112, it says links to additional resources, and that's also linked to from the OWLID homepage. Neil's website is www.lowimpactdevelopment.org. That's all one word, .org. And we have about 20 or 30 resources posted on the resources page. And both the resources, the slides from today, and the audio file will be available at the website essentially for a long time, maybe forever. So you can come back later on, you can look at these resources, you can play the audio file, you can look at the slides, and you can visit some of these other sites. In addition, EPA has a smart growth website, which is epa.gov, and then / all one word, smart growth. We also have a Watershed Academy module. Makes a connection between smart growth and water resource protection. And as we mentioned at the beginning, and go to the Watershed Forum website that we developed to, one of our categories on that is low impact development if people want to exchange to Success Stories websites and ask questions. And I'd like to take one moment to remind people to fill out the feedback form, which is also located on the website and linked to from the resources page. Is there additional questions for Neil while we still have a few minutes left?
Yes, this is Region 3. I have a quick question about the Virginia project that was described in Haymount. I believe someone mentioned that the permitting authority and the county worked together to help speed up the permitting process and the review and approval process, and I'd just like to find out where I can get more information about that.
But I think in general, this is Doug Bish with Williamsburg Environmental. The Corps of Engineers, Army Corps of Engineers, Norfolk District, Bruce Williams, and I think a lot of it driven by Hal Wiggins out of their Fredericksburg field office have really pushed a lot of low impact development. Like from the perspective of concern about secondary or indirect impacts to downstream hydrology, you know, yeah, you can preserve all the streams, but are you in effect impacting them anyways because you've dramatically altered the hydrology? So they've worked with the DEQ. They've had a technical committee going on for about 2 years to look at policies and incorporating, you know, some low-impact perspectives into their review process for avoidance and minimization. And if you want to, my email address is on the last slide of the presentation. Feel free to email me, and I can send you some more information about that from the results of that committee. In this project, we looked at phase 1A, and we were concerned, like, oh, we better start thinking about permitting because we're breaking ground real soon. And then, you know, looking at it, we don't have any impacts. So, but the agencies certainly are much more receptive to the projects just because of the environmental ethic and the tone of the project that's been set throughout. And that always aids in the permit process, whether or not it's a formal consideration or not.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You can take this. That website, the Haymont Project, is also linked to from our resources page, along with Section 319 success stories, some of the examples, like the Puget Sound example, the Prince George's County Buyer Retention Manual, the mouse example. So if you go to the resources website, many of these questions and further information is available from those locations. All right, well, I'd like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to thank Neil Weinstein from the Low Impact Development Center for his presentation today, and also like to thank Shelley and Doug for their information as well.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.